Taste of Ireland with Ireland's Blue Book. A romantic collection of Irish country house hotels, manor houses, castles and restaurants. Ireland'sBlueBook.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
You're very welcome to A Taste of Ireland, and my special guest this evening was awarded the top aesthetic practitioner in the world 2019 at the My Face, My Body Global Awards in Las Vegas. He won the Doctor of the Year UK 2019 and Doctor of the Year UK and Ireland in 2018 at the Safety in Beauty Diamond Awards in London. He has won the Royal Society of Medicine Research Poster Award, and he is among one of the few doctors in the world to have won the coveted AMEC Trophy three times, no less, Paris twice and in Monaco in 2019 for various research related to the use of stem cells, etc. He was Michael Jackson's doctor at one stage. He's been on CNN, Sky News, the BBC, Newsweek, as well as all our own stations here. And I have to say, Dr. Patrick Tracy, renowned dermatologist, you're very welcome to the programme. How are you doing this evening?
I'm fine. Thank you very much, Ed.
I'm exhausted reading all that out, right? Because I was wondering if you had the... I was reading through your stuff, Patrick, and your wonderful books. And of course, we're here to talk about your new book, which is very, very, very interesting indeed, The Needle and the Damage Done. But I was wondering if you had discovered the power of bilocation, where you can be in two places at the one time, because you've some amazing stuff that you've done here over the years.
People used to say that to me all the time, and particularly, do you have a brother? How could you be, you know, sort of fit so much into a lifetime? I think maybe what people tend to forget is I look a bit younger than my age, and one of the songs I suppose we'll be doing later on is America by Simon and Garfunkel, and it reminds me back to those wonderful years whenever you see America for the first time, you know, when I was 18 or 19. So I was there initially in 1977 when the Son of Sam, I suppose, stalked the city. Elvis Presley died that year. And I met a lot of famous people, from John Lennon right through to Jackie Onassis. And Elton John was in Waikiki D in Central Park. So a lot of people tend to wonder, what? You're not that old yet, are you? Chronologically, I suppose I fitted a lot into the years that I've been here, but most people assume that, I suppose, a doctor tends to spend a lot of time in the one place, particularly if you're training for something like plastic surgery. You tend to be in the one place for like 4 to 6 years, whereas I suppose I used my time to travel. Originally, when I was in Northern Ireland, the war kicked off there. I became a victim of it, believe it or not. You can read that, I suppose, in the book. So I transferred to the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. And then because I was, I suppose, a wee bit older to be doing plastic surgery, I was very lucky that I was able to work in New Zealand, Australia, the United States, South Africa, Gibraltar, Solomon Isles. You know, so I got a good run around the world.
And I saw you were in Saddam Hussein's Iraq as well, and you were locked up there for a while. It's like a Jason Bourne movie watching it.
Yeah, you're right. I was at the fall of the Berlin Wall, I suppose, November 89, and then 2 or 3 weeks later I was in Iraq. If you remember, Park, who was a subsidiary of Aer Lingus, ran the Ibn al-Battar Hospital. So we had a situation where we were a tertiary referral centre. So instead of them sending cardiac transplants or renal transplants to Dublin, London or Paris, again, they just sent them to our hospital. So we had a lot of very highly specialised staff. But in March of that year, the Times ran an article regarding the Iraqi people who'd been gassed in El Habalia. You remember that period. And we were getting an awful lot of people from Soleimani and El Habalia into our ICU with aplastic anemia. So I ventured up into the area. I was doing, I suppose, articles for the Fermanagh Herald at the time. And I got arrested in Peshmerga gear, believe it or not, by the Iraqi army in Forbidden Land, and I got a year's jail sentence, but they never transferred me from the police station because he was invading Kuwait at exactly the same time. So I was there for 5 days, and I got... An Iraqi commander came down to me one morning, left a gun beside me on the bed and said, you think we're all animals, do you? Or barbarians, he said. And I said, no, I don't. He says, listen, I know James Joyce. I know Trinity College. And he lifted me and put my arm behind my back and roughed me up a bit, but threw me outside the station and then threw my bag out after me. So I was really blessed. And I don't think the taxi driver that was with me ever got out. And it was a horrible experience because we could hear the people being, I suppose, tortured at night time and the screams, and it was Iraq of the period, I presume, you know. So I flew back to Dublin. I didn't even go back to hospital to collect my gear. And August the 1st, 2nd, we were in the, that was July the 28th, we were at the Galway Races, and he invaded Kuwait, and everybody who was my friends in the hospital were held as, I suppose, prisoners. Whereas, you know, I was in a situation beforehand particularly, and not to labour on Iraq, but if you remember in that period also, Fazrov Bazrov, the journalist, was beheaded, and Daphne Parrish got a life sentence. I was driving their car. Well, that was the staff health car, my car, and... because I took over in that period afterwards. But that was the license that I had. Lucky enough to never check it. Yeah.
Yeah, fascinating story, Patrick. Were you always, I mean, in terms of your original, going back to your origin stories, were you always attracted to dermatology? Or, you know, was that something that was big for you?
Well, to an extent, and just to correct that, I suppose I'm what they call a gypsy. I'm a general practitioner with special interest dermatology. So I've done 2 years derm rather than the 4 years normally. And I suppose that sort of qualification gave me the ability to travel the world. Now, I was very lucky from the point of view that when I was a medical student back in 1984, I worked in the Mayo Clinic in dermatology and wrote a sentinel paper on malignant melanomas. And then because I had a special interest, I suppose, in derm and in malignant melanomas, I worked in Queensland, which had the highest rate of malignant melanomas in the world. So I ran a skin cancer centre there with three doctors under me, and we dealt specifically in malignant melanomas. And also I was associated with the Princess Alexandra Hospital in Brisbane. We were trying to work out a vaccine. So I've always been interested in dermatology, and almost since I came back to Ireland, I've done nothing else but dermatology.
Yeah, skin cancer. And I see, Patrick, over the years you've been involved in training nearly 3,000 doctors or more.
Yes. The reason for that is two or threefold. The first thing is I travel the world to congresses, and when you're there, they take advantage of you to run, we'll say, a workshop for 200 or 300 doctors. It's amazing over a period of years how many people that you actually train. And then we've run a mentorship program on Aylesbury Clinic where I allow doctors from all over the world to come and just sit in with us, and I've never charged them. We've always had that policy. So we've just recently had somebody from Gaza, it's amazing, and Bethlehem, and then we've doctors from Norway, some from the United States, South Africa, and they come and spend, you know, sort of a week with us. So I had somebody from Canada recently, two from Canada actually, and it's wonderful, you know, and sort of we just do our own thing, and the patients have been kind enough to allow that sort of mentorship program to exist. So, yeah.
Excellent. You were accidentally jabbed with the needle from a HIV patient in 1987. That must have been a bit scary, was it?
That was some of the most terrible times of my life. And I must say that the Eastern Health Board of the period did not handle the whole situation very well. I was in a hospital, James Connolly. We had a young 17-year-old asthmatic in that was going cyanotic, and I was looking for an arterial blood gas. I'd pulled 10 mils of blood off him in the days before Vacutainers. He knew that he was in trouble. He turned around to show me a sort of vein that he would have used for mainlining, but he knocked everything off the bed, stuck it in my leg, and it was incredible how badly they handled it. The first thing is I went to theatre, told a friend of mine who was doing a hip operation just starting, just cut that lump out of my leg. Now, this was in 1987, before antiretroviral, before any drugs at all. when the sister found out, she asked me to leave the hospital, started screaming at me, "You're not double glove, you're exposing my doctor." And she says, "I don't care if you're a doctor or not." And she closed down theatre and she moved the patient to another unit. Now, in that week also, James Connolly destroyed a €23,000 gastroscope because it was HIV. There was no cure. They didn't know enough about it. It's not like now. And I was calling at the Royal College of Surgeons, and the person who query counselled me, I don't want to mention her name because her son is still a colleague of mine and works as a neurologist in Dublin, but she turned around to me and says, "Okay, listen, Patrick, we better look at the facts straight here." She said, 41 needle sticks in the world, 4 have died, but they've all been IM or IVIM, including one in London, a nurse only last week. And I said, "But of course I'm IVIM." She says, "Oh, nobody told me." She says, "Well, you're probably going to die then, aren't you?" That was the response I got. So as a consequence,
incredible how it's changed.
It's incredible when you think that recently there was a case in the paper where a policeman got spat at with a query HIV and drove 23 miles to his station with a spittle on his eye so that he could claim compensation. And I think he got paid out $100,000. I had to travel the world for 3 years, getting tested 3 times a year, like is here. Never once did the hospital come back and say to me, "How are you?" or, you know, "What was the consequence of your illness?" You know, it's just so different in this day and age, you know.
Of course. And you see,
totally,
of course,
thankless,
we see renowned sports stars now from all over, you know, who have all come out and said, you know, because I suppose nowadays with the treatment and everything, it's just changed so much.
Well, let's put it this way. Everybody's excited now about COVID. COVID's a bloody walk in the park compared to what HIV was.
Yeah.
HIV at the time, you remember those ads with the Grim Reaper, you know, everybody's going to get this.
The big the big black slab of stone.
You're not allowed to kiss anybody. You remember Magic Johnson, all that whole period?
Yeah, yeah.
And then Cary Grant, you know, and it wasn't until a few years later even that there was a drug for it. But they really shamelessly isolated doctors, and I wasn't the only one, and just, you know, sort of forgot about them. And anyway, I only mention this because it's part of my story. I went to New Zealand, next stop Antarctica. It was Dunedin, Invercargill. And
so where else would you be going?
Well, it's far away from everything. And unfortunately, I suppose in that period as well, my girlfriend, who we were going to get engaged, and I separated, but I wouldn't blame her for that. It was just part of the story.
Fear, I suppose, you know, in those days. Now, we're going to come back after the break, Patrick. We're going to talk about Michael Jackson and the Berlin Wall and Bowie. But tell us, what have you picked for us for your first choice of music this evening?
Oh, well, thank you for that. You know, I was thinking, because of the fact that we just mentioned the needle stick, Needle and the Damage Done. Now, that's the name of the book as well. And we know, of course, it's Neil Young's song. He wrote it in 1972 about his friend Danny Whitter, who was a member of Crazy Horse, who died of heroin overdose that year as well. But the reason that we called it Needle and the Damage Done, believe it or not, wasn't because of the needle stick injury. One of the awards that I got was that I came up with a solution on a global protocol that's used around the world now, how to reverse what we call vascular occlusion. So if somebody is injecting dermal fillers into somebody's face and inject it accidentally into an artery, then it's the same as having a heart attack. That part of the face just dies off because there isn't collateral circulation. So the fact that you mentioned Michael Jackson is interesting. Michael flew from the United States to me in about 2005, 2006 to get filler taken out of his face, and nobody had used it before. And then all these vascular occlusions started happening, and I had gained quite a lot of experience in how to reverse them. I suppose from a medical point of view, that's why it's called The Needle and the Damage Done.
A Taste of Ireland with Ireland's Blue Book, a romantic collection of Irish country house hotels, manor houses, castles and restaurants. Ireland'sBlueBook.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
My special guest this evening, renowned dermatologist, Dr. Patrick Tracy. Your previous book, Patrick, Behind the Mask, was very interesting, relating to the kind of behind the surgeon's mask and your relationship with Michael Jackson. A lot of people would be fascinated about this.
Oh, well, I suppose the name of the book is funny. Again, was a song title. Of course, it was one of Michael Jackson's song titles, and also was an initial memoir of the story behind the surgical mask. Yes, Michael and I had become friends over a period of time, and you may remember the Sun ran a big story when he was doing This Is It. He was coming back to see us in Dublin, actually just a few days before he died. But anyway, that's another day's work. It's funny the way, in memory of the people who lived in that period, that a lot of them are actually dead now. If I could, I suppose, extrapolate slightly, you had me thinking when Michael came to us first, I had to remove some dermal filler from his face because he wanted to meet the Queen. Now, the interesting thing was he was very shy. He went over to London, even though we had the filler removed from his face and he was looking fantastic. He wouldn't meet the Queen. It was the opening of Casino Royale, I think it was, and he was too shy to actually meet her. So all that worked for nothing. And Michael did use propofol with us to get it out. But, you know, CNN ran into that many times ago. So it's funny, when I was going to remove the filler from his face, I had to phone up Arnie Klein with Michael one day. And Arnie, when we came on the phone, Arnie says to me first, Patrick, I have somebody here who wants to talk to you. And I said, who's that? He says, Carrie Fisher wants to talk to you. And hi, Patrick, for looking after Michael so much, blah, 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 and we were talking on. And then Arnie was saying, you know, I've got a paper in derm surgery this time. I want you to look at it. By sheer coincidence, I'm not trying to sort of say I have many papers in derm surgery, but I had one also. And we sort of had discussed that. So we were rattling on for a while with Arnie. But I mentioned it because Carrie Fisher's dead. Darnie Klein's
dead. Princess Leia.
Yes. Michael Jackson's dead. So everybody in that conversation is dead.
Yeah.
And then another funny thing that happened one day, that Michael was in the clinic. He wanted to go down to South Africa to do a concert for HIV, and he knew I'd done quite a lot of work in Africa in HIV, because I took a certain empathy with the people who suffer from the disease, having nearly been there myself, but sort of had survived it. So he was arranging a concert through Grace Rwamba. She sort of had been brought up in Rwanda. So we had promoters on the phone and that sort of thing. So one day he gave me the phone, and I was depigmenting the bottom of his ankles and legs, because Michael, as you know, had vitiligo and he was totally black and white. And from the neck up, we sort of depigmented him from his hands and from his, I suppose, his ankles area. And he also suffered from lupus, and depigmenting him left him susceptible to basal cell carcinomas, which is the reason he always wore a mask and the reason that he sort of wore an umbrella as well. And some of that was under my instructions as well, believe it or not, because I suppose I know a little more about this than I'm willing to say at the moment, particularly regarding the potential for getting skin cancers and that. So anyway, we're there, and I'm thinking hydroquinone may not cut it. So we got a new compound that I got from South Africa called Amelon. But the problem with it is it used to sort of go hard on people. And so he's lying on the bed like this here. He's laughing on the phone with somebody, as he often did. Michael was good fun, actually. And it's going hard. And he says to me, Patrick, do you want to take this call? And I said, no, I'm just waving my head. And he says, from South Africa. And I'm thinking it's a concert promoter. And I said, can't he ring me back? And he says, no, like it's here, you know. And he says, take it. So I take it. And I said, hi, are you organizing this concert? And he says to me, no, my son is. And I said, oh, right, okay, good. And are you in Cape Town? And he says, yeah, I'm in Cape Town. And I said, I used to live in Cape Town. And he says, where do you live? I said, I lived in Clifton. I lived in Bantry Bay.
Oh, the posh areas, of course.
Yeah, well, sort of. Cape Town's a little bit like that anyway.
Yeah.
So he told me, he says, I know all those areas, like this here, you know. And I said, listen. And then he says, thank you for looking after Michael, the same as Carrie Fisher did. And I thought that was unusual for a concert promoter. Why would he say that? So I said, listen, you're getting me at a bad time. I'm treating Michael at the moment. I'm in the middle of a procedure, so I'll hand you back to Michael. And Michael wouldn't take the phone back, and he says, it's Madiba. And I didn't know at the time that Nelson Mandela was called Madiba. I guess so, yes, you know. And I sort of, you know, shoot the breeze of Madiba. And then I sort of give the phone back to Michael, and he starts laughing. And then I said to myself, that was Nelson Mandela. So I said, give me the phone back. And he says, no. He said, originally, I thought you would want to talk to him. And but I said, I didn't know it was him. And then...
Oh, yes, this man.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. Well, I lived in Cape Town for 7 years. And
you know,
the funny thing, my birthday is the 18th of July. And it's the same as Nelson Mandela.
Oh,
so
God.
I used to have the best birthdays ever, Patrick, down in Cape Town. But that's, God. I digress. The book is full. The book we're talking about, the Mike Jackson book, it's full of kind of jaw-dropping anecdotes, I suppose, of the surreal encounters that followed with Michael, right? If anyone wants to get that, it's really good. But what I thought was very funny as well, you mentioned about him being gripped by some whimsical kleptomania regarding products from the clinic and stuff like that, which I thought was very funny, because I think a lot of us would be susceptible to that when we visit hotels on some occasion.
We had a big glass studio in the clinic where we kept our products, you know? And I come in this day, Michael was in it, and he had this big jacket on, that big black jacket he used to have with about 10 things in it, and some of these products were like 200 or 300 euros a piece. He had it full. And I turn around and says, Michael,
Wacko, put that back.
You can't take those with me. He's laughing. He's going for the door, running like a child, you know. I said, listen, please, because the thing is, Michael was short of money at that time also. I mean, to be fair, he didn't have the money that people thought he did. That all came after he died. And I knew I'd probably never get bloody paid for them. So I sort of turned around and says, Michael, leave this back. So I stopped him like this here and started taking all the things out of his pocket. And there was a lot. There was about easily 2,000 or 3,000.
They were cleaned out.
I says, the women in Ireland would love some of this here. And so anyway, that evening, or maybe the evening afterwards, I was down in the house. And my mother had died not too long before it. And I shouldn't say not too long before it. She died sometime before it. But she gave me a jacket before she died that sort of I had been down in the house with. And it went missing, you know. And I couldn't figure out where it was. And we searched the house and we couldn't figure it. And then we found asleep up in the room with my jacket over his head. Well, actually on a sort of a sofa. And so I didn't find him. Michael did, like he's here, you know. So because we'd been looking for maybe about 10 or 15 minutes and there was a taxi waiting for me, Michael came into me and sort of says, Patrick, I found you the jacket. And I said, where was it? He says, oh, blanket was sleeping right over him. Sure, he's a thief like his father, he says, in an Irish accent. Yeah.
Brilliant. I mean, incredible. I mean, the book, I mean, you go on just to quickly, I won't go into too much detail, but you talk about him having like Jesus Christ status, really, because of course the following he had, I mean, people were obsessed with him. So he was such a character. I mean, people just absolutely went crazy for him when you see the concerts and stuff.
And also the humanitarian aspect of his life. You know, I mean, he gave all the millions from, you know, some of the records just over to humanitarian projects. You know, we are the world. I mean, that he gave 42 million or something across, you know, sort of that alone. Yeah. And the fact he went into all the hospitals. Now, the thing is, he wanted to go into the Dublin hospitals.
You're an honorary ambassador of the Michael Jackson Legacy Foundation as well, which is, you know, so obviously
build orphanages
doing a lot of
around
work.
The world. We've built some in Mirabilis in Haiti, in the Prince, in Liberia, in Monrovia. And I go into that in the book in a little more detail.
Wonderful. Now, I just want to bring you back a bit, because a place you're from, Fermanagh, right?
Yes.
A place that I absolutely love. And you were telling me the Lakeland County.
Yes.
A beautiful place. And you were telling me earlier that it was actually really before the war. It was really the place to go in Ireland when you were going on holidays. And
absolutely.
Of course, if anyone hasn't been there, they'll know.
You know, forget that it was more popular before the war started, a destination than Kerry was. Absolutely.
Yeah, incredible. And you grew up there during the Troubles, Patrick, as well. I suppose you saw an awful lot of stuff then. I suppose that would have influenced you as well.
Yeah, the first couple of chapters are growing up in that environment. And certainly I was there not only at the beginning of the war, but unfortunately right in the thick of it. Because don't forget, when I went to Queen's Belfast, the Elms is on the Malone Road. That backs onto the Lisburn Road and the Shankill Road working class areas. And, Lisburn Road isn't a working class area per se, but it's very close to it. And that's when the tit-for-tat murders were. Do you know when that guy Murphy took a knife to his passengers in the taxi and killed 23 Catholics.
Very tragic. You know?
So that was right in our area. Mm. And then I got attacked there myself, unfortunately. End up with some broken legs and had to head south. And
but a very, I mean, obviously part of what moulded you as well and your own ability and your own humanitarian philosophy, I suppose. So from there, Patrick, let's quickly go to, you saw the Berlin Wall come down.
Yes, I was there during the period the Berlin Wall came down. And believe it or not, I also stood on the Berlin Wall as part of it coming down and was filmed by French television. That did change our lives, there's no doubt about it. And I suppose we'd be leading into another song very soon. And Germany was very close to my heart. I've lived in Germany. Ich spreche ein bisschen Deutsch before.
Ah,
sehr gut.
Yeah.
No, but the interesting thing was that I suppose during the period that I took off college, because Margaret Thatcher pulled my grant, and suddenly I was left in one of the most expensive colleges in the world with no way to pay it, because Margaret Thatcher took off my years at Queen's before I sort of moved, stroke fled south. And as a consequence, I was in a six-year course in the Royal College of Surgeons in Dublin, which is a wonderful institution. And Margaret wouldn't pay my last 3 years. So as a consequence, you know, what's up. So I started smuggling cars to Germany to make a living. And during that period, as it was 1983, I had some time in my hands and I travelled with David Bowie down from, I suppose, Brussels, Frankfurt, down to Munich. I got to know him quite well. He's actually Irish, you know that. His granny is from Virginia, Peggy Burns.
County Cavan.
County Cavan.
Wow.
They moved to a thing. And believe it or not, a lot of people don't know as well, when he sang Rabble Rebel in the Point Depot in 1991, if you watch it on YouTube, at the end of it, he stands and says, Chucky Arla, you know, which is quite surprising.
Yes.
But, he does it in a Brixton accent, though, so it doesn't come out as easy as you think it would. But when I travelled with David during that period, I suppose, listened to the stories and all the rest. And but the Munich concert I really wanted to go to, and I sort of was building up towards it because I was living in Munich at the time, I had to move a fleet of 12 Mercedes from Dortmund to Istanbul. So I was team leader and that was getting my way through college.
There's another book in that.
No, it's all in the book. So you're fine.
I know, I saw it.
Yeah. But as a consequence of that, I suppose, which if it leads us into our second song, because David, I suppose, lived in Kreuzberg and lived in Berlin in the period of 1977, I was going to play, if it's okay, Ed, Heroes by David Bowie as our next song. That, I suppose, encapsulates many things. Meeting and stroke, having a friendship with David Bowie at the time. David's own period when he flew from his drug life in Los Angeles to live in environments of Berlin. Night in November, that cold bloody night in 1989 when the wall came down. David living there, the association, I suppose, with him during the Sirius Moonlight Tour. And I'd love you to bring back all those memories at once. Heroes by David Bowie.
A Taste of Ireland with Ireland's Blue Book, a romantic collection of Irish country house hotels, manor houses, castles and restaurants. Ireland'sBlueBook.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
And you're very welcome back to A Taste of Ireland with my special guest this evening, Dr. Patrick Tracy, world-renowned dermatologist. Patrick, fascinating stories there about your travels, I must say. I was boggle-eyed looking at the amazing awards that you've received over the years, Patrick. Well-deserved.
But believe it or not, I started accumulating awards at a very young age. I don't know why. I won the British Amateur Young Scientist of the Year when I was 15. Harold Wilson gave me the award. And at the time, I showed that certain sound waves could make plants grow further. So I used what we call an AFO, an audio frequency oscillator, to make mung beans grow about twice or three times their height. And it was around the same time that Prince Charles started talking to plants. I don't know whether he had read something about my award. myself and Michael Jackson one day were talking about the differences in our fathers. And when we grew up, we didn't have that much money. And I had no acoustic wadding to make the little boxes to do the control experiments in. So my father cut down the garage sign from outside our, I suppose, garage at the time. And when I woke up in the morning, he had all these boxes made. And Michael turned around and says, you know, the difference in our background between my father and your father, you know. Now, I used to take the piss out of Michael a bit. You know, we'd have a couple of drinks and we'd just start shooting the breeze. And Michael turned around and he's really interested in plants, as you know, his big, I suppose, blue operas like Erdsong. We weren't sure how it worked. Now, there were some theories. You have things called positive and negative inotropes that work on plants. And one of the things may have been just that the sound waves could have just shot the soil particles to allow ethylene gas to escape. And as a negative inotrope was going missing, then the positive inotropes like IAA and acetic acid and that could make the plant grow higher. So, I mean, I didn't have enough science at the time to work it out. So Michael turned around and said, do you think that it was the sound waves that the plants love them, like it's here? And I said, I don't think so, Michael, you know. And he says, do you think if you would have played Erdsong to them, you know? And I turned around and said, no, Michael, actually, probably what is happening is the sound waves are blasting the soil and releasing ethylene gas. And he knew that I was sort of half taking the piss out of him. So he turned around and says, oh, if that's the case, then you should have just played Billie Jean and turned it up really loud. Yeah. Okay.
Fascinating. I mean, incredible how you were able to come to that. I mean, and you know, it is amazing about plants and in fact what can influence them, I suppose.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then when I was 16, I won the Aer Lingus Young Scientist Award, believe it or not. At least the biochemistry aspect of it. Then, I suppose, in terms of my research, I go into it a little bit in my book, but I was among the first doctors to use, I suppose, botulinum toxin for migraine back now 23 years ago nearly. I wasn't the first doctor ever. That was in a new book I'm writing on aesthetics, and I sort of give him the thing. But in 2001, 2002, we were running migraine clinics here, botulinum toxin, and the neurologists in the hospitals wouldn't agree with me, even though we'd done the trials on it and had initiated some of the original PREMP protocols that are widely used now. So it wasn't until 2010, that the Irish and British regulatory authorities passed it. And then some of the other research were included. When HIV started originally, we came up with aesthetics to change lipodystrophy syndrome because the original drugs unfortunately destroyed people's faces. And we weren't sure whether people were just living longer and this was a extra phase of AIDS or whether it was the drugs, but it was proven to be the drugs. In 2003, Bono and I were at the United Nations Humanitarian Awards, and he gave them to Alex Katino, who for his work in HIV in Africa. He was from Kampala in Uganda. He told me he had none of those patients at all. So I knew then it has to be the drugs is doing it, because his patients either died later from AIDS or performed abstinence so they didn't spread it. But we actually had patients on antiretrovirals, particularly Retrovir. But I mean, they became so gaunt-looking that they commit suicide just from the way they looked. It was tremendous. Yeah. So I treated about 45 patients from Ireland and all around the world in that, I suppose, particular period. But the biggest one that I won a lot of awards for recently was writing the protocols for how to reverse when dermal fillers block arteries. And now the whole world does it, which is great that it's accepted. But the original doses I was using, about 10 to 20 times higher than it was being advocated, and now that's accepted worldwide. In Russia and Ukraine, they even call it the Tracy Protocol, but anyway.
We could just come back to your book for a minute, the new book. That, I mean, sure. If people do want to educate themselves, Patrick, and I mean, we've only a certain amount of time here this evening. I could actually talk to you for 2 days if we had a chance. But the book, what I have to say is, right, I mean, it's a gripping page turner.
There's enough of that. You know, you grew up in Northern Ireland and then you become a victim of trouble. So you have to go and live somewhere else. Then you go and live somewhere else, you become a doctor, and suddenly you get injected by a needle. So suddenly you have to go and live somewhere again, because in each instance, the people who are supposed to be protecting you aren't doing the job that they're supposed to be doing. And then as soon as, my mum got ill when I was away, came back to Ireland, and suddenly we hit the Irish recession. that horrendous Irish recession.
You know,
I lost nearly everything I had, but I had 5 patients of mine that commit suicide in that period. And just like as the years pass and you're working 6 days a week, you know, sort of just to get back to half of where you were, suddenly COVID happens, you know. Mm. But thankfully, we're coming out the other end. And yes, I did stick with it through adversity. And I suppose people have been wonderful. And certainly it's nice coming out the other end now. And we've so many things coming together. We have a new skin brand that'll be launched in New York on St. Patrick's Day. People seem to be really loving that, thankfully. And we're rebuilding clinics. We had a lot of clinics around the world, particularly with the hair brand. We had over 20. And they were, I suppose, in Saudi, Dubai, London, Moscow, Serbia, Istanbul. I was the person who was among the first, if not the first, to bring FUE hair transplant to India back in 2007, along with Kostas Giotis. And now Kostas and I, I suppose, are getting back together again to a large extent. And we're going to... I'm getting too old now to make so many clinics again, but certainly one or two.
Well, you don't look it. I can tell you.
I'm using Dr. Tracy's skin
for the listeners.
Products.
I'm looking at you here, and I tell you, I'm not sure you're telling the truth about your age at all. Can I ask you one of the things? Well, the humanitarian work that you've done.
Yes.
The photographs in the book, Patrick, of Haiti and Africa. I mean, we were saying about Cape Town earlier. They're absolutely beautiful. I mean, all these lovely patients and the stuff you've done. I think that's something that really stood out for me about it.
Thank you. Humanitarianism is an interesting thing. And most people who are humanitarian don't even like to talk about it because you're taking advantage of, I suppose, why you're doing it in the first place. I integrate a lot with church people who do a lot of good work, but also the difference in humanitarian is that I suppose somebody involved in humanitarian work through a church is really buying somebody's soul and they're selling them, you know, some sort of better life as a consequence on earth. Now, I have written a book recently on pandemics. It's worth looking at to see how the church influenced people's judgment during pandemics. I'll not go into it at this point in time. So humanitarian work, you really get everything back from it. Not only the people so lovely, but I've been fortunate enough to do humanitarian work, I suppose, in Kenya, Malawi, Liberia, Uganda recently. Only time I really get off now is Christmas time, because I don't, after that recession, get, you know, sort of many holidays. So it's great you can go and, you know, sort of do humanitarian work. And we have a lot of projects that have just come to fruition. We've built a school recently with the help of some Dublin colleagues of mine, Peter Gannon, Clowns for Haiti, and Peter Hanley in Donnybrook, and it's called St. Patrick's on the Hill. So that just opened a few weeks ago, and then we built with the help of Dennis O'Brien. Dennis gets a bad slate unfairly, but Dennis gave 350,000 to build a new high school in Mirabilis because the old one had fallen down, killed a couple of students, unfortunately, along with Bishop Darcillian and Gladys. And we were able to build a whole new high school in Mirabilis away from the impact of the epicentre of the earthquake. And recently, we sort of were able to help out in a lot of projects in Africa. Africa gets into your soul.
Well, for anybody who wants to get more information, and Patrick, for anybody who wants to have a cracking good read, The Needle and the Damage Done by Dr. Patrick Tracy is available, all good book outlets, on Amazon, of course. It's been an absolute pleasure, Patrick, talking to you. As I said earlier, I could talk to you for days. You know, you're a fascinating man altogether.
We'll have a pint in Crow's in Ballsbridge when
this
is all over.
Yeah, I'd be very happy with that. Yeah, it would be great. But coming soon. Watch this space. Patrick, what have you chosen for your final piece of music this evening?
Yeah, it's funny. I thought long and hard about this to an extent. As I mentioned earlier in the first third of the programme, when we go to America first, and I've lived in Santa Barbara for quite a while, I've lived in New York, I've lived in Miami. I think America is a wonderful place, despite what our misgivings we may have had about it. I always thought Simon & Garfunkel's America, you know, it sort of was almost the pursuit of young people in love with the American dream. So it touches to me of Hemingway's work, and spent some time down in Cuba writing about him. Maybe even Jack Kerouac's On the Road, or maybe even Fitzgerald's, you know, sort of that whole wonderful aspect of America. But then in pursuit of their dream of travelling, you know, they run out of cigarettes, they grow bored, they go to sleep, they count the cars on the turnpike, you know. It turns into more like a Shane McGowan's type, I suppose, fairy tale of New York, where they go there with the dream, but then it sort of turns the other way. It's interesting. America has always been fascinating for me. When I cross the state line from Nevada into California, I always know I'm in California. I felt, I suppose, I don't know why, but for whatever reason, almost more at home almost in California than I did even in Ireland, as much as I love living in Ireland. There's always something special about California. And I mean, I lived there for quite a while, property in Santa Barbara, and I sometimes wonder when the rain's dripping on my face why I ever left California. So Simon & Garfunkel's America would be a lovely one to end it on.
Dr. Patrick Tracy, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Let us be lovers, we'll marry our fortunes together.